From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. If you've driven around the Las Vegas Valley in recent days, you know the 4th of July is right around the corner just by all the roadside fireworks stands that have popped up. Fireworks at the best of times can be a risky proposition. In a desert, they're downright dangerous. That's why only so-called safe and sane fireworks are allowed. However, that's not going to stop some from crossing over the county line and buying illegal fireworks, stuff like mortars, bottle rockets, and firecrackers, and turning the holiday into what feels like a war zone to some residents. Here to talk about what's at risk this holiday weekend is Deputy Fire Marshal Rick Rozier with the City of Las Vegas' Fire Department. Rick, welcome to State of Nevada.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for having me.
Las Vegans often go to places like Pahrump or neighboring reservations to buy fireworks that are illegal in Clark County. Where should people be buying their fireworks from?
Now, this year we're telling everybody to buy local and stay legal. And basically what that means is the 200 or so booths that we have spread out all over the valley, those sell the safe and sane fireworks that were tested and approved for sale by the Fire Prevention Association of Nevada.
So what qualifies as a safe and sane firework?
Well, a lot of things. The main things that we're looking for, they don't explode. They don't travel through the air, not to say they won't shoot sparks in the air. And they don't travel across the ground. So those are the main three things that we're looking for, and then they're effectively tested by the association to make sure they don't burst into flames after the effect is over and those types of things.
So the 4th of July can be chaotic, to say the least, for emergency services. What kind of call increase do you see?
You know, actually, I spoke to the dispatching chief this morning just to kind of get those numbers, and last year they got approximately 1,200 calls between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. on the 4th. And to put that in its perspective, on average, they get about 1,400 calls in a 24-hour shift.
Oh, wow. So that is quite an increase just for one shift there. Talk about staffing. Is it an all hands on deck?
Yeah. For the firefighting crews, it's standard operating practice where all the stations are filled, all the apparatus is being utilized. In our prevention division, it's basically everybody's working that night. It's a long night, a lot of enforcement and inspection activities, but yeah, it's pretty much all hands on deck.
During the holiday, talk about what kind of calls you're responding to, at least from, you know, is it going to be all fire situations or are you also dealing with a lot of medical things?
Last year, for example, we had 125 incidences regarding fireworks, and we had some burn injuries. Outside fires, which, you know, are basically palm trees and pine trees and, you know, all the other vegetation that catches on fire. And then we had 7 building fires. And that's fairly common for that type of evening.
Local municipalities in Southern Nevada are on a campaign they're calling Safe and Sane. We mentioned those Safe and Sane fireworks just a moment ago. Metro has been confiscating illegal fireworks. Do these sort of things actually work, these safety campaigns?
You know, it's a drop in the bucket, to be honest with you. We do our best to try to have an impact, but the reality of it is if you look outside on the 4th, it is literally like a war zone outside. And the few number of people, I mean, even though Metro has quite a few people working that evening, you know, with this target in mind, it really does hopefully create a little bit of buzz out there, but the reality of it is I wish it would do more. I wish that we could make a bigger impact, but that's why these education and messages are that important. Try to get out in front of it and explain the hazards that are associated with these type of fireworks and hope that the people would do it on their own.
You know, we had Metro on last year where they talked about they have police stationed in neighborhoods where they just watch the skies and they follow the fireworks and they go to one house after another. What sort of punishment or fines could people be faced if they're caught with illegal fireworks?
I don't know about all four jurisdictions, but the county and the city of Las Vegas have both passed civil ordinances, which allow us to fine, I believe, $250 for the first offense and $500 for additional offenses. And I believe in the county, they also have disposal fees, which can get extremely high when you're looking at those fireworks as being a hazardous material.
That's Rick Rozier, Deputy Fire Marshal for the City of Las Vegas. I want to turn now to someone on the post-incident side, fireworks safety. Dr. Jay Coates, he's the medical director of the Sunrise Hospital's Burn and Reconstruction Center. Jay, welcome to State of Nevada.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Just want to note that you are a working doctor and could get called away at any time, so we are going to be aware of that. You know, talk to me a little bit. What are common injuries from improperly handling fireworks?
Well, you know, it's usually things where people are trying to hold on to them, throw them at each other, premature detonation. So, you know, we'll see a lot of those followed by people that are just hit by, you know, stray fire shrapnel, if you will, little sparks or things like that that may directly burn them or set their clothes on fire.
Do you mostly see adults, kids? Is it a mix of both?
It's a mix of both. And, you know, it's the 4th of July, so besides the fireworks, a lot of times we'll see things where, you know, from cookouts, propane explosions, people catching on fire like that. But there's definitely a mix. A definite uptick in kids, though, during the 4th of July for what we see.
Just how much of an increase over the 4th of July weekend do you see?
Well, you know, on an average week, I'll see anywhere from 10 to 30 burns minor. So probably about double that, you know, over the weekend. It can, you know, Monday's going to be interesting because a lot of these are things that are going to require some sort of surgical intervention or treatment. So, you know, it makes for a busy week the following week.
And what type of, I mean, what parts of the body are being burned?
Well, it's usually arms, legs, mostly things like that. Sometimes people get hit in the face, but it's typically hands and arms.
Based on your experience, have firework-related injuries become more common in recent years?
I got to tell you, I don't think they've become more common. It's pretty steady that what we see over the 4th of July. I can't say that I've seen an absolute increase. You know, we'll have those one-offs here and there where there's large injuries from them. But, you know, it's usually things like people burning their fingers or something like that.
So at what point should somebody who's gotten a burn seek medical care?
Well, anytime it looks like it's blistered, it's painful. Most of these are bad first, maybe second degree burns. But, you know, when you start seeing blistering and redness or it just becomes painful, it's worth seeking attention at that point in time because burns can progress over time sometimes. And what doesn't look too bad today, tomorrow might actually look a little bit worse.
So talk me through the process. You know, somebody has come in with a bad burn into the emergency room. What's going to happen over the next day, a couple of days, or maybe a couple of weeks?
Sure. It depends on, again, how severe the burn is. But let's say your average second degree burn where you've blistered or sloughed off skin. We're in a place now where we take most of those to the operating room because it's quite painful to debride those. We'll debride in the operating room, take off all that dead skin, uncover everything. We will put on one of a few different products depending on where the burn is. We use a lot of times what's called a cadaver graft, which is a donated skin product. It's like a biological Band-Aid. We'll also use amnion, which is a stem cell. We'll put this over the burn, and then we monitor. It's usually anything that doesn't heal within 10 to 14 days will likely require a skin graft.
How often do you see those sorts of burns, I guess, on these major holiday weekends?
We're
doing skin grafts, I guess.
Skin, yeah. I mean, that we all the time. It'd be rare for me to have a holiday where I don't see them, so.
Are there any particular firework handling habits or even particular firework types that you would recommend people avoid to stay safe this year?
Well, it's common sense, which isn't always so common, but it's a matter of, like I said, you know, light them and get away. Don't hold on to them. Don't throw them. Don't throw them at each other. You know, those sort of things are the things that are really going to protect you from getting burned. And then once they go off, as you said, we've got a lot different fireworks in the city now than we used to, the things that fly through the air. But if they hit something and they explode or there's sparks coming off of them, you know, try to stay clear of that so they don't hit either your skin directly or set your clothing on fire. And then always have something nearby, a water source, fire extinguisher, or something like that in case there is a fire.
And what should people do if they have a small burn, you know, something they can treat at home?
First thing is run cold water over it to stop the burning process. And then most likely, if you can just put an antibiotic ointment on it or something like that, or a small bandage to cover it, you'll be fine. And if it progresses or looks worse, then yeah, you should seek treatment or have it looked at.
Rick, I want to fold you back into the conversation. What should people have on hand if there is a fire before authorities come?
Well, what we usually try to recommend is, you know, while you're shooting off the fireworks, have a bucket of water or a charged hose available at all times. Soak the fireworks. We do get a lot of fire calls from people throwing their fireworks away in their trash can. They rekindle, set the trash can on fire, and then it spreads to the house. So keep the trash can away, even if you've soaked it. Keep it away from your house 10 feet. And, you know, again, we just recommend soaking them or watering them down for, you know, an hour, 2 hours after you use them.
It seems like things get louder and more chaotic every 4th. We hear people say that a lot, too. Is that something that's really happening, to your knowledge?
You know, that's a good question, and I wish we had better metrics to quantify that. All I can tell you is anecdotal from the several years that I've been doing this. It doesn't look like it's getting any better. It looks about the same. Maybe with more people comes more fireworks, you know, as the population grows. You know, we're looking. The city is doing, I think, 5 shows, and then we've got the big show that's going on the Strip, which is going to be similar to the one that people see on New Year's Eve. So we're encouraging people to go watch a free show. It's going to be a lot better than anything you can buy. It's going to be nice. You can relax, enjoy yourself, and watch the free show. I know Clark County is doing several shows. So there's options. So we hope that the people will take the safer option and enjoy themselves this 4th of July.
That is where we are going to have to leave it. Rick Rozier is a deputy fire marshal with the City of Las Vegas' fire department. Jay Coates is the medical director of Sunrise Hospital's Burn and Reconstruction Center. Rick, Jay, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And have a great day.
And as a note, the City of Las Vegas and Sunrise Hospital's parent company, HCA Healthcare, are financial supporters of Nevada Public Radio. It may not feel like we're approaching the height of summer, but by next week, temperatures in Las Vegas should be back into the triple digits again. That's one reason why Nevada's 2 most populous communities are working to follow a new state law requiring them to add heat mitigation efforts to their master plans. Under AB 96, communities with more than 100,000 residents must develop plans that bolster access to public cooling stations, drinking water, so-called cool building practices, and more shade over paved surfaces. It's aimed at saving lives. According to the Clark County Coroner's Office, more than 800 people died because of heat in 2024 and 2025. But are the changes enough to help? Here to discuss that is Alan Hilaly. He's the water and environmental reporter for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Alan, thanks for coming in and chatting with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Before we talk about the law, I want to ask about a statistic that gets bandied about a lot. It is that Reno and Las Vegas are the country's 2 fastest warming cities. Where does that statistic come from?
Yeah, it comes from an independent group of climate scientists that formed a nonprofit called Climate Central. Every day on Earth Day, they release an analysis of temperatures, average temperatures since 1970 for every major city across the nation. And for the past at least half a decade, Reno and Las Vegas have been at the top of that list. So when we're talking about extreme heat planning, things like planting trees and making our buildings better, you know, that is a very tangible metric for us to say, you know, we need to do something about this problem now to plan for the future.
So how would this new heat mitigation law, AB 96, address that extreme heat?
Right. So basically what the law did is it required, and as you said, any municipality, local government with more than 100,000 residents to look at how they can amend their city codes, their master plans to potentially address some of these specific issues like access to drinking water and all the other things that you mentioned. Essentially, you know, what it means in practice at this point is, at least here in Southern Nevada, they have created another working group with all of the municipalities, City of Henderson, Boulder City, you know, Clark County. They all came together. They hired an outside consultant to kind of do this analysis of what are the things that are missing from our master plans. I think there is some hesitance about whether that actually does something tangibly, right? I mean, we can put language in our city codes or language in our master plans about cooling centers and all these things, but without tangible funding sources or dedicated attention, and also any real tangible enforcement action, any way to hold our city governments accountable, There is just a question of whether, you know, a quick language change does mean anything in practice.
It's like you're looking at my notes, because my next question is about enforcement. There's no teeth in this. So are lawmakers who, you know, brought this law forward last session talking about bringing it back next year?
I don't think they're talking about this specifically. I think the focus, at least that I have, what I understand is there is a really concerted effort to maybe catch Nevada up to cities like Phoenix, LA, Miami, in potentially creating a statewide heat office, a dedicated official at the state government who can find funding sources for these things, plan year-round to work with our local governments on these very specific things. I think there's just been, you know, what I hear all the time is that nobody before maybe 2022 wanted to, quote, own this issue, right? I mean, it's just so fragmented across all these local governments. And the longer we let that happen, the longer, the more people die. So I think one of the things that they might do at the session, I know Assemblymember Cynthia Moore is looking at introducing something, is to create that statewide heat office, which is a similar model to some of the other hottest cities in the country.
We've already experienced at least 3 extreme heat advisories this year. Have we seen the cities or counties act any differently this summer as compared to previous summers?
I wouldn't say so. I think really our only official response here in Southern Nevada and in Northern Nevada has been these cooling centers, right? There are community centers, there are libraries, there are places that open their doors and basically can't tell you to get out of there if you're there to cool down. But what we've seen in real academic research from the Desert Research Institute is that these aren't being used well. They're not advertised. There is a stigma associated with them. People associate them with homelessness. So there is, you know, questions just about how can we make these cooling centers more effective, more well attended, and how can we place them in the neighborhoods where we need them most? And we do have that data about where heat is most acutely felt when we're in these really hot summers. So, you know, I don't think there's really been anything different this year. The municipalities are still very focused on planting trees, something that takes, you know, upwards of half a decade to really have any tangible impact. But I will say they are, you know, targeting those to the most urban heat islands that they can. So no, nothing's really changed, but I think they're at the table, they're talking. There was the Southern Nevada Extreme Heat Summit, and you know, people are having the conversations. I think they're just looking for the way to take this to the next level.
We got about 30 seconds left, Alan. Who supported this law? Where did it come from?
Yeah, so this law, I believe it was first put forward in 2023. Governor Lombardo did veto it. It did have a lot of, you know, support from the Democrats up in Carson City, but it is a bipartisan issue, right? Nobody wants people dying of extreme heat in their districts.
Alan Halaly is the water and environmental reporter for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Alan, it's always good to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The plan for managing Colorado River water is set to expire later this year. Some 40 million people rely on it for municipal needs, including roughly 2.5 million residents of the Las Vegas Valley. Water managers from 7 river states have been trying to hammer out a deal before the federal government steps in and imposes severe cuts, which could happen later this summer. Recently, Heidi Kaiser sat down with Southern Nevada Water Authority General Manager John Ensminger for an overview and update. Their conversation was the first installment of our new live event series, SON In Depth, and the full interview will be on knpr.org later this week. In the meantime, here's a snippet of that conversation. And as a note, KNPR gets financial support from the Southern Nevada Water Authority.
Hi, John.
Hello again.
I want to go back to the 1922 agreement or the 1944 agreement that you referenced earlier. You know, it's often sort of collectively called the Law of the River. And many people who are here tonight and listening in will know by now that it was based on flawed math, among other things. The average flows that it was using that got divided up and allocated among the seven states that rely on those flows were higher than the overall averages we've seen since then. And the resulting overallocation doesn't even take into account climate change, drought, the record low snowpack we saw this year. And that's just one issue, albeit a very big one. There are other problems with the law that have also been identified over the years. And, you know, we often hear summaries of the current situation that focus on haggling or even fighting among the basin states. Let's for a moment just turn that around. And I want to think about it as a mandate to fix or improve the agreement. Let's say that we were going to be able to account for things like climate change and indigenous people's water rights, some of the big problems with the previous agreement. What are the top two or three problems like that with the current law that you believe you and the other water managers should be tackling right now?
Well, it takes a lot more than me and six other governors' representatives. But if you want to really drill into the dysfunctional components of the law of the river, I would identify three. The first one is the treaty between the United States and Mexico. Article 10B says you can only curtail deliveries to Mexico in the event of an extraordinary drought. But there's no definition of extraordinary drought. It's probably the worst written provision of law I've ever read. The second one would be the really regretful decision of the state of Arizona to agree to the 1968 Act, where they got federal funding to build the Central Arizona Project and subordinate and make junior all of their water rights to the state of California, which makes it incredibly difficult to get California to contribute. And then the third is just the poorly worded Article 3 in the compact itself, which leaves the upper basin thinking we divided the river 50-50 and leaves the lower basin thinking they owe us all of our water even if they have to go to zero. So you just have these really dysfunctional junctures within a century of river law that allow people to dig in on different positions and make it very difficult to reach compromise. Mm.
Another way that I've been thinking about this is that there's really not a monolithic law of the river. And you touched on this earlier. There's a starting agreement, and then there's a bunch of alterations, a bunch of addendums, infrastructure plans, legal settlements, minutes, treaties, other updates over the years. It's all really just sort of a Byzantine management plan. To give folks an idea what Colorado River system negotiations look like, it took 7 years, if I'm not mistaken, to come to the agreement on the 2019 drought contingency plan. Is that right?
I guess I would estimate 5 years, but it takes years, to come up with these agreements.
And I want you to help me understand what it means when we hear that, you know, the law or the agreement is expiring this year, given that Byzantine nature of the management plan. Is it that referring to the drought shortage period addressed in the interim guidelines from 2007, or is it the 2019 contingency plan, or are there, you know, parts of the management plan that are going to stay in effect and we're going to replace everything else? Are we chucking the whole thing out the window and coming up with a new plan? What does that look like?
Well, as with most answers in water, it's not entirely linear. There are the big parts that are expiring are the 2007 guidelines, which govern how you create intentionally created surplus in Lake Mead, which govern how much shortages need to be taken in the lower basin, which govern operations between Lake Powell and Lake Mead. The drought contingency plan that I referred to as being approved by Congress expires, and three different minutes with Mexico all expire essentially on October 1st this year.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are some, not evergreen provisions, but some provisions that continue on. The ability of the lower basin entities to access our intentionally created surplus through 2036 stay in place and have been blessed by Congress. Nevada's ability to move water from the Virgin and Muddy Rivers through Lake Mead and access it at our facilities at Saddle Island stay in place through 2056. So it's not 100% expiration, but it's a big enough expiration that if we don't have another plan in place, you're leaving it to the federal government to act unilaterally.
Yeah. And the Interior Department has set and reset, and they've been missed deadlines for the basin states to come up with this plan that you were just talking about. Most recently, I think it was Valentine's Day. The states yet don't have anything firm, a few proposals, and you made one in early May. I believe it was first reported locally by Alan Halali of the Las Vegas Review-Journal. It involved, as I understand it, lower basin states taking voluntary cuts in order to save up to 3.2 million acre feet of water by 2028. Where does that proposal stand?
I think Nevada, in our comments, we put out a proposal. California immediately endorsed it. And then we got a response from the Department of Interior, and we spent the last couple of weeks talking with them about that. And I think that's the most likely 28-month operating plan. Like, how do you get to the end of 2028 without steering the car into Supreme Court litigation? So I think there's been some very productive conversations, and certainly Nevada can live within what we have proposed as our contributions. So we'll just have to see if we can land that particular airplane. There's a hearing in front of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee today, where Senator Cortez Masto asked a couple of fairly pointed questions of the Assistant Secretary of Water and Science. So it's a bad pun, but it's a fluid situation.
And in that proposal, how much would Nevada be giving up?
So California's proposed reducing their basic apportionment by 440,000 acre feet. Arizona's proposing to reduce their basic apportionment by 760,000 acre feet. And Nevada has proposed reducing our basic apportionment by 50,000 acre feet. But the important thing to keep in mind there is our basic apportionment is 300,000 acre feet. So yeah, that would mean our legal ability to divert water off of our basic apportionment would go to 250,000 acre feet. But our ICS, our intentionally created surplus off the Virgin and Muddy, is 30,000. So we'd still have 280. And last year, we used 198. So under anything but the most catastrophic conditions for the next 28 months, we would still be banking more extra water in Lake Mead. We wouldn't actually be required to, cut off any particular thing.
So it's been reported by multiple outlets that the Bureau of Reclamation is now aiming for this summer as their latest deadline. They want something from you guys. And the Bureau and you have both suggested short-term plans that get revisited every couple of years. And assuming this would allow for prioritization of problems to solve, putting, say, the most urgent first. So, if it takes 5 years to negotiate 1 minute, let's say we only have 2 years to tackle something, you're going to start with the most urgent things, right? So what would be those first couple of issues that you have to tackle in that interim period?
Well, I think you have to deal with the states in the upper basin, Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, and New Mexico, and get them to accept the fact that they're going to have to be part of the solution. Because thus far, they really have kind of stiff-armed us and just said, I think different states have different reasons, but we have not made progress with them being willing to be part of the solution. And if they continue to refuse to be part of that solution, I'm not sure litigation is avoidable. So we got to really press on that, and not just at the gubernatorial representative level. I mean, senators and utility managers and, different people have to get involved in that conversation. If we could get any meaningful contribution out of those four states, then I think you have to turn your attention to the durability of the lower basin reductions and then the Palo-de-Mead release operations and how you release water from upstream, Flaming Gorge, Blue Mesa, Navajo, the major components of how you construct a long-term durable deal like that.
John Ensminger is among the negotiators who are trying to find enough water for the 40 million people who use the Colorado River, in addition to all of us who use it here in Las Vegas. John, thank you so much for being here and talking with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure, Heidi.
School's out for summer, and that means it's time to hit the books? Well, sort of. In an effort to keep kids and adults reading through the season known for vacations and playtime, libraries across the state have launched reading challenge programs to boost literacy. And over the years, those efforts have become more creative. Washoe County Library System has curated reading challenge lists to reflect its theme of dinosaurs, archaeology, and paleontology. Las Vegas Clark County Library District has a few tricks up its sleeve as well. In early June, we spoke with Claudia Melton. She's the branch manager at the West Charleston Library, part of the Las Vegas Clark County Library District. We wanted to get her take on summer reading programs and why they're important. Here's that conversation. Claudia, thank you for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So why do libraries go to such lengths to promote reading through the summer?
Well, it's important for us to promote reading through the summer because we're trying to fill the gap and address something called the summer slide. Basically, the summer slide is the reading loss and the academic loss that can occur for children during the summer. As you pointed out, they're having fun, they're playing, they're having a good time, but reading is also a practice, and our goal is to make sure that they practice that through the summer by incentivizing it, inviting them into a community space like a library, and making sure they have fun with it.
Do you feel a larger sense of responsibility to help increase reading among kids and adults for that matter, given that literacy across the board in Nevada ranks towards the bottom nationally?
We feel a sense that we need to promote community. And without promoting community and having folks enjoy the space, enjoy the reading, we can't improve literacy. Reading for children, our goal is to make it fun. And if it's not fun, of course they're not going to want to do it. So we make sure that we have fun story times, STEAM programming, and arts and cultural events that incentivize it and let people know you're not reading alone. This is a community sport. And we want children to know from a very young age that we're all in it together to support them in their reading journey.
I very much felt like I lived out of the library through the summer growing up. Do you see a notable uptick in patronage through these summer months, or does it stay relatively stable?
So in Las Vegas, we're unique. People are coming into the library not just to read, but also to escape the heat. But it's a great environment where people can settle in, join community, read, and also participate in our different programs. So we do see an uptick, especially when it gets very, very hot outside.
Let's talk about these challenges program to get kids to read. You know, how do you get kids to participate, essentially?
So we do promotional opportunities in the libraries. We go out to schools and different outreach and community events, and we let people know all of the great challenges that are happening. So specifically, our challenge started on May 15th, and it ends July 15th. And it's very simple. You can go to our website. You can sign up there, or even better, visit one of our 25 locations and sign up and get a reading log. All you have to do to participate is read for 20 hours. And I know 20 hours during the summer, that sounds like a lot. Right? It's really not. It only breaks down to about 20 minutes a day. And this is the fun part for us. This is when we get to start giving you and kids prizes. So kids, they get a free book when they sign up. Adults, they get something called a book buck when they sign up. And then they can shop in one of the library district bookstores in order to select their own titles.
How heavy do you have to incentivize it with prizes to get folks on board?
So the great thing about Vegas is Vegas already has a culture of readers. There are folks who work behind the scenes in security, in nursing facilities who love to read. So we don't have to heavily incentivize it, but we find it's just an additional way to support people. And who doesn't enjoy a pan pizza from Pizza Hut? Who doesn't enjoy a free treat from Freed's Bakery? If we can provide that, I want that. It's something, of course, we want to give to our community.
Those personal pan pizzas, man, that's what really triggered all that reading when I was a kid.
A whole generation of millennials and Gen X started to read because of these pan pizzas.
Let's talk about how it actually works. How do people log their reading?
So they have two options. They can do it on a physical bookmark if they visit their local library. They can just write off where they've been reading. Or if they go online, they can log in and log it there. All of the instructions are on our website, or they can visit one of the libraries and we can go through the log with them.
We should note that the library districts in Henderson, North Las Vegas, and Washoe County all have summer reading challenges all currently underway. And we'll have links to them on our website at knpr.org. You know, does the library arrange new displays and in-cap collections to reflect their promotion of summer reading?
We do, but we do it all year round. One of the big things we do is we try to promote cultural events, holidays. So right now in my library, we have a display up for mystery. We're going to have displays and signage up for Juneteenth programs that we're doing. We just try to make sure we're not only promoting the book collection, but we're also promoting the different events that we have going on as well that support the community.
What are some of the books or genres that seem to fly off the shelves these summers?
Oh, that's my favorite question. Okay, so for the kids, right now, Wings of Fire by Tui Sutherland, that is a popular one. Percy Jackson and the Olympians, that's been popular for the past 10 years. That's what our teens love to read. We have a new series. J graphic novels are really popular. I believe it's called Jelly and Narwhal, or Narwhal and Jelly. Those are the things that kids are pulling off of the shelf that's getting them to their prizes.
I recall summer reading displays that were filled with a lot of the same books that were acquired during summer months, from To Kill a Mockingbird to The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. You know, are these kids reading for summer in preparation for fall as well?
Some are and some aren't. Yesterday, we talked to a student in the library and we asked her what was she excited to read this summer. She said, I'm finishing Jane Eyre and then I'm moving on to Jane Austen. She's not reading it specifically for school. It's because she wants to. But we also have books for kids like her, but we also have books for kids who want to read the graphic novels, who want to read a fun adventure, who want to travel to a new place. Our goal is to have a very diverse collection that meets the needs of students where they are, whether they're just reading for fun or to get ready for the next school year. But we do have those classic books on our shelf.
You mentioned that people come in during the summer months because it's hot, trying to escape that heat. So how much does the library serve as an actual third place during the summer?
We are a third space 365 days out of the year. There are very few places anymore where you don't have to pay to be there. We don't require you to have a library card. You can just walk in and enjoy the space. And as a third space, what we're noticing is people are connecting to our Wi-Fi. They are seeing all of the different programs we have. So, for example, at my library, we have 3D printing. We have a hydroponics program. We have a sewing program. We also have book clubs and writing clubs as well. It's an opportunity for us to bring people in so that they can figure out what engagement level they want. If they just want to sit quietly and enjoy the space, they're welcome to do so. But if they want to participate deeper, we also have those opportunities available to them as well.
Claudia, we have about 30 seconds left. What are you reading this summer?
Okay, what am I reading? So I am reading The Mermaid of Black Conch. It is about a mermaid in the Caribbean who's been cursed, and she starts to flirt with a very cute Rastafarian. So it's a little bit of romance, a little bit of mystery. It's been a fun read so far. So that is one book I recommend if you want to take a little island trip to the Caribbean this summer.
The Las Vegas Clark County Library District Summer Reading Challenge goes through July 15th. We'll have more information linked at knpr.org. Claudia Melton is the branch manager for the West Charleston Library. Claudia, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And as a note, KNPR does receive financial support from the Las Vegas Clark County Library District. The effort to get children to read goes beyond logging hours and winning prizes. One Las Vegas barber decided to incentivize reading by offering free haircuts to kids who read books. His books. KNPR's Ann Davis has more.
At Heat City Fade's Barbershop in the Charleston Heights neighborhood of Las Vegas, a cadre of barbers shave, cut, and towel off patrons. Today, they're all school-aged children. Each of them is wearing a cape with a book in their lap. It's part of the deal. In exchange for reading aloud to their barbers, they each get a free haircut. It's a special program for Nevada Reading Week, which is held annually in March. But for James Allen, the barbershop's owner, encouraging literacy is a year-round mission.
I'm actually a juvenile probation officer as well. and I work with kids, and I see so many kids that struggle, that's up in age, and they still don't know how to read. So it just inspired me to try and do something that's going to help these kids learn how to read and pick up a book rather than a cell phone all day.
Research indicates that over the summer months, kids can lose about 20% of their school year literacy gains. It's a phenomenon commonly referred to as the summer slide. Alan, who's known by community members as Spody, uses the books he authors and illustrates to tackle the growing childhood literacy problem. His books are also meant to guide young readers through real-life problems, such as bullying and peer pressure.
My idea of being in the barbershop is being in the community.
Less than 40% of Clark County third graders in 2023 were considered to be proficient in reading. For parents like David McClare, it's a serious concern.
As parents, we need to do our job as much as we can to actually boost their education, boost their reading.
In the meantime, education officials say parents can help ward off the worst effects of the summer slide by integrating at least 20 minutes of reading into kids' daily lives. Ann Davis, Campier News.
There's no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Here to filter out a few of the best options for this holiday weekend is KNPR's Mike Brevet, who oversees the arts and culture beat for Nevada Public Radio. Hi, Mike.
Yo.
So you want to talk about Art Town in Reno?
I sure do. I just saw this year's very stuffed Art Town calendar. Paul, how do you not go out every single night in July?
It can be tough. There's usually a lot going on every day.
I would probably just have to pause every streamer and movie theater subscription I had if I was in a city with an Art Town. And for those of you who haven't heard us talk about it before, Art Town is this month-long arts and entertainment bacchanalia over in Reno, and nobody's interests are overlooked. There are the capital C culture events like ballet and Shakespeare and Japanese drum performances and mariachi and classical music. But then you also have the events that are centered around like Disney music and musical theater, and there's tribute acts. And that's, you know, those are all for people looking for something maybe a little more familiar. Paul, when you are going to do Art Town events, what do you like to check out?
As you mentioned, there's always a lot of concerts, theater performances. There's also a lot of local history lectures. So that's where I tend to spend my time.
Oh. I feel like if I was up there, I would personally would like to check out the Kronos Quartet. They don't come to Nevada very often. They're actually playing July 9th at the Robert Z. Hawkins Amphitheater. Or maybe I'd wait a week and I would go to the UNR Quad. That is where there'll be a performance of The Tentit. They are a local 10-piece that is trying to, in their words, disrupt Reno's status quo. And that's something I can wholeheartedly support in any city. I should also mention at this point that there are multiple options each day for children, and especially a lot of like hands-on activities that usually involve the visual arts. And some of these events are free, and others, like especially the concerts, are ticketed and usually come with a price. If you want to investigate on your own, we'll have a link at knpr.org.
We'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the holiday weekend. Mike, does Art Town have anything related to Independence Day?
Yes. On July 3rd, the Discovery will host a children's event with a holiday sing-along. And then on July 4th, the big night, Reno Philharmonic will perform at UNR's Mackey Stadium. They've got a free concert that's ending with a big drone show.
What about for Southern Nevada? I know there will be a lot of fireworks shows to choose from. Is there anything to do beyond that?
Yeah, there are several things that acknowledge or commemorate the holiday and likely end before the final fireworks show if you still want to end the night with a bang. If you wanted to enjoy your Saturday afternoon and honor the U.S.'s 250th, maybe also take a break to somewhere that doesn't have triple-digit temperatures, then you want to go to Lee Canyon near Mount Charleston from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. They'll have the usual outdoor offerings out there, but they'll also have a live band in the afternoon, and they've got this burger and beer lunch special priced at, ahem, $17.76. And this is just in time for a brand new 2-mile hiking path that is now up there called the High Pines Trail.
You had me at hiking and beer.
Right. But if those are maybe are a little more than what you're looking for, how about a play? How about a play about the U.S. Constitution?
It's very much in the national conversation this week.
Right. For a public fit theater company in Las Vegas, it's been in the conversation since last year where they first produce this work, and they're bringing it back for July 3rd at Clark County Library. It's called What the Constitution Means to Me. It's part civics history lesson and also part memoir, and it's written by Heidi Schreck, and it alternates between her as a high school debater and also her as an adult. And it addresses the country's very important document, the rights that are contained within it, and why those rights are now frequently endangered. It's free. And if you miss it on Friday, you can see it the following Saturday, July 11th, at the Windmill Library. And that would be an afternoon performance.
Is that a little heavy for the holiday weekend?
Well, that particular production is balanced out by a good dose of humor, according to what I've read. However, if you still like your historical theater to be a lot more lively and maybe filled with some song, then you should consider going to Super Summer Theater. They're doing their take on the Broadway musical 1776, and that centers another important U.S. document, the Declaration of Independence, and that's being staged starting tonight, July 1st, and it goes through July 18th, and yes, there is a July 4th show.
Two options in the Spring Mountains. Sounds like a good time. Mike, that's all the time we have for this week. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Paul.